Corrine Brown says she's innocent as her federal corruption trial gets underway. Lenny Curry gets a big win on pension. Will he seek a higher office? And Steinmart says no to Ivanka Trump clothing. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen anytime. You can also stream us live now on Facebook. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line right now. Let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, a look at the locally produced film, Never Go Back. Plus, we'll tell you about this weekend's Intersections Festival in Springfield, all of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable of all-stars as we welcome blogger Fred Matthews back to Studio 5. Good to see you. Next Page podcaster Charles Griggs here today.
Good morning, Melissa.
And our own WJCT analyst John Burr.
Great to be here.
Guys, so good to have you here. And lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from speculation around Mayor Lenny Curry's political future, which he says is misplaced, to the Jacksonville-based Steinmart dropping Ivanka Trump's clothing line. But our top story this Friday, attorneys for former Florida Congresswoman Corrine Brown say her staff betrayed her in financial transactions that led to the fraud chases she's facing in court. In her first official day of her corruption trial, the 24-year veteran of Congress faces a slew of charges of fraud and conspiracy, and they mostly stem from the education charity she set up, One Door for Education. Prosecutors say it was a sham charity and that she used the money from it as a slush fund. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look at the Corrine Brown trial. Let us know what you think at 549-2937 or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on Facebook. Charles Griggs, let's begin with you. The prosecutor coming out swinging saying that Corrine Brown did have knowledge of how the money from her charity, One Door for Education, was actually being spent. The defense is saying that one of her assistants was really the mastermind. So I guess it will come down to who the jury believes.
Yeah, actually, yeah, it looks like the prosecution is trying to lay the case that that Corrine Brown knew about the donations that were being taken in and what the use for what they were going to be used for. However, from a defense standpoint, you know, it's going to be up to her to prove that she didn't have any knowledge of that, how the money was being spent or how it was being worked through the organization. And I think that from the defense standpoint, they're trying to prove that it's going to be all circumstantial. So what we're seeing is that how the prosecution is sort of, you know, bringing people in and saying, yes, we gave the money. We donated money with the intent that the money would be used for a specific purpose, but it wasn't. Now that we're finding out it wasn't, we want to make sure that you understand that that wasn't what we were supposed to be. But it is. It's going to be interesting in the end because we innocent until proven guilty, and
right.
I think that Congresswoman Brown probably wouldn't have put herself in this position in terms of going to trial if she didn't believe that she had a good chance at getting off.
Fred Matthews, Brown's defense lawyer, is saying that she didn't really have knowledge about where all the money coming into her accounts was going. The prosecutors, though, laid out evidence showing that how after her assistant Ronnie Simmons would put money into her account, there'd be a withdrawal from her account and it would go toward everything from vacations to meals out and things like that. So how do you see the defense making the case here that Corrine Brown didn't collude in these financial transactions?
Well, I mean, they make the case by simply saying what they continue to say. She did not go to the bank and put the money in until we hear from Ronnie Simmons that he was instructed by the congresswoman to take the money to the bank. That's going to be the thread. That's the one thread that everybody's waiting for to see if Ronnie, who has been there since the beginning, before the beginning that she went to Congress when she was in the House. So everybody knows that he is the link. And until he gets on the stand and says,
is he going to flip? Is he going to sell her out?
Well, I mean, he's taken the plea.
He's already taken the deal. John Burr.
Well, if by make the case you mean that are they going to convince the jury that she didn't know about all this financial stuff going on? I don't think so. I mean, the movement of the money that we're seeing the FBI talk about it that is pretty damning in and of itself. I mean, you know, when you have contributions coming in and then, you know, very soon thereafter, the same amount of money going out to her account, you know, that's a hard one to explain away.
It looks like the defense believes they can make the case that all of these transactions were murky enough in itself that there's doubt that she was actually the one instructing for the transactions to be made. And like Fred said, once Simmons is the person on the hot seat, you'll see whether or not, you know, which direction he goes. But it's pretty clear that since he's already cut his own deal, that that he's probably going to try to implicate
her
in some type of way.
It's 549-2937 to join our Friday media roundtable, and it was really striking to see how difficult a time they had even seating a jury. People in this area have strong opinions about former Congresswoman Corrine Brown and believe either very strongly in her guilt or very strongly already in her innocence. Yeah. Seating a jury wasn't easy for the legal teams in there.
High profile enough. We get on media.
It wasn't easy, but they made a decision when they got down to the last 46 that they had to seat a jury. And of course, this is a federal court, so they had a larger swath of folks to pull from. And both sides knew what they wanted. That was the other part of this. This was a very strategically done. When they came down to the last 46, just as all the names were pretty much, everything but the names were put out to the public by the local media as to who was on the jury. Everybody there, both the prosecution and defense, pretty much knew what they were going to come down to and what they were going to tolerate as jurors. So there's no real surprise there. The question will still come down to who's going to say what on that witness list to tie the former congresswoman to the allegations, to the money that was put into her account and how much she was spending.
And she's officially facing hundreds of years in prison. In reality, if Corrine Brown is convicted, what's the real sentence going to be?
Well, that's to be decided. She is 70 years old.
Right.
I doubt that they'll throw the book at her if she is convicted. But, you know, what really is surprising to me here is the defense, by implication, is suggesting that former Congresswoman Brown was getting up in age. She wasn't quite as mentally sharp as she used to be.
These are defenses that have worked for so many other politicians in the past, too, by the way. Male politicians.
That's not really the Corrine Brown I've been.
I know, but that is that's not an uncommon tack to take.
You take whatever strategy is necessary to make, you know, to get you, you know, the relief that you're looking for. And besides, you take in consideration, again, age. You think about where she's, the seat she's sitting in, and when she's trying to decide whether or not she's going to plea, you know, cop a plea early or go to trial, you know, her really only defense is to go to trial, because, you know, you roll the dice and let the chips fall where they may, and you stand on what you believe in. And in this case, she believes, I think from her defense, she believes that she can, you know, they can create enough murkiness with the prosecution's evidence that they can get her off, or at least something reduced or manageable for a sentence.
What about the character witnesses the defense is expected to bring in? Everyone from UNF President John Delaney to, I think I've heard, even Jesse Jackson may come in and talk, vouch for Corrine Brown. Think that'll make a difference?
Not really. Because that's to be expected. I mean, it's the same as if for the first folks who've already gone there and have given money from the former CEO of CXX was there. We understand that Susie Wiles has already testified about did they know the money was going into her pocket? And these are prosecution witnesses, all of which have known Corrine for years in her capacity. So, but it's not going to make that terrible much difference here. The key here, I mean, we know she has worldwide personality, character witnesses, so that's not an issue. The issue is still at the same. Who's going to tie that thread?
Right.
Who's going to make the thread there? And it comes to Ronnie, from my view.
It really is a follow the money type of situation. You know, it's also fascinating insight into what's going on. I mean, you've got people testifying that they would hand over checks for thousands of dollars, blank checks, with nobody filled out paid to order of anyone.
That shows you what a member of Congress can do in the way of juice if they're perceived as being influential, well, helping the district.
It shows you how business is done in Jacksonville, I'll tell you that.
That's just part of the game. I mean, everybody who's run for office and has any kind of name and you're running for office, you understand and know how the game is played. And this just lays it open a little more for the public to see how much money is going there. And it sort of makes a lot of people, a lot of other nonprofits jealous because it takes months to get someone to give you $1,000 without filling out a whole lot of forms. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'll be honest, I've run a couple of nonprofits before and I've applied to CSX. The most I could get out for them was to print a program for me, but that's about the extent of it.
Fred saying, what am I, chopped liver? All right, let's go to your calls. Lydia on the west side. Hi, Lydia. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to start this off by letting you know that I am a generally non-political person, and I do not necessarily personally care for Corrine Brown. However, I'm a Jacksonville native, never lived anywhere else. And it seems funny to me, first off, she should be aware of where any money is going. She should keep account of it because it has her name on it. Ultimately, it is her responsibility, and I'm tired of our society as a whole saying, it's okay, you don't have to take responsibility, we'll find somebody else to blame. However, it seems very strange to me that she's been doing a job for a very long time, and all of a sudden, all of this bad stuff pops up, and the jury that is seated, I do not believe, is fair. I'm a Caucasian woman. We're supposed to be tried by a jury of our peers. She is not. There is an imbalance. It is racially tilted to white male, and that is wrong.
Thanks, Lydia. Charles.
Well, you know, we've heard that before, concerns about, you know, why Congresswoman Brown has even in this position in the first place. Some people believe that it's because that she was bucking the system related to the redistricting, and this is sort of punishment for that. So, you know, we've heard concerns about or comments about her, you know, this happening at this point in time. And so I don't know if that's not going to have any impact on the trial, but at the same time, people are
That's a perception some hold.
Definitely.
No proof of that, but that's a perception some hold. Okay. Jacob in St. Augustine. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I actually have a question. I don't know what Congressman Brown's position on this charity is. And let me clarify so you know where I'm coming from. If she's on the leadership of this charity, if she's the CEO or the president or something of that sort, and the argument that they're making is that she doesn't understand where the money is going, then that's different than if she were just acting as a fundraiser for the charity. So it really seems similar to me to the Wells Fargo case that just recently happened last year, where the CEO for a long time said he had no idea that his middle managers were creating all these fake accounts for people, and it took a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to really hold him accountable and get him removed from the board of Wells Fargo to get clawbacks on his pay. And I really just, it seems like there's this perception that even though she was running things in this organization, and I don't know if that's true or not, but if she was, that she shouldn't be held accountable for the bad things that organization did. And if that's true, if she really was running things, she must be held accountable for it. Even if she didn't know, she should have known it was her responsibility to know.
Thanks, Jacob. Thanks for that.
Well, it's my understanding she wasn't running the organization. It was Ronnie Simmons and who has actually had the operational responsibility for...
Well, Carla Wiley was the executive director of the nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And it appears that Ronnie, who was, of course, paid as Kareem Brown's legislative aide, chief of staff, was basically the go-between from that to Kareem. And of course, there was a personal relationship, as we now know, between the director of the nonprofit and Ronnie Simmons at one point. So Kareem was not, I think she served for a period of time. They had her listed as a board member at one point in time, but she was not. From all the documents we've been able to see so far, was not a signer on the account, had no direct control of what the nonprofit was doing, at least on paper. So that's the key part. The young lady, Carla Wiley, all of them, of course, are living up in Virginia at this point. By the way, this is where the nonprofit is based. It's right. Not based around here at all.
Right.
And even Ronnie Simmons is living, has residence up in Virginia now, at least had that until this started.
Let's go to Samantha in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Samantha.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to say that if your name is attached to an organization, you are responsible in terms of knowing what the organization is doing. You can't excuse the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. I think that we get into a very foggy area here with regard to ethics, morals. At 70 years old, one knows right from wrong. And if one chooses not to do it, it's not everyone else's fault.
All right. Thanks, Samantha, for that. And we're going to continue to follow the trial, which is expected to last another week or two. But in the meantime, we're also on the show talking about all the top stories of the week. It's 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, Mayor Lenny Curry signed into law Tuesday the biggest policy priority of his administration, pension reform. Curry says now that pension is out of the way, he can focus on other issues.
So I'm going to continue to focus on those priorities. We will now have more wherewithal to actually invest in the things that are consistent with what those priorities are.
Curry is also pushing back against rumors that after this big accomplishment, maybe he's eyeing a higher office. What do you think, listeners? Is Lenny Curry looking beyond Jacksonville in terms of his political ambitions? It's 549-2937. Of course, the mayor denies that. John Burr.
I think he is. He's a relatively young man. He's certainly ambitious. He's got a good head on his shoulders. He's got a nice political win under his belt. But I don't think he's really interested in being the CFO of Florida. I think he'd much rather be the governor of Florida.
Can he make a race for that? Charles Griggs.
Well, I think the mayor has certainly done himself well by getting an A-plus for moving pension reform through, because this was something he campaigned on, and from dealing with the legislature to making sure all of that, he got a unanimous vote through the council. I mean, he did everything like, you know, it was like a stroke of genius, pretty much. I mean, I don't think I've seen a politician work a policy issue like we've seen the mayor work this one, and since I've been around, even Mayor Delaney, when he had Better Jacksonville, it was difficult for him to get the type of support he did with that. So with that political win under him, you know, I think the future is his if he wants to pursue certain things. But he, of course, him being the type of guy that he is probably going to be smart about that down the road.
Fred.
Well, I think he had the wind at his back. The council was an easy sale because they've been worn out with this. They were out of solutions. Even Bill Gulliford did.
They were ready to sign something.
you can sort of tell that between Bill Gulliford and John Crescenbenny, even they didn't have any fight left in them about this thing.
There's a reason for that, Fred. There's a reason because you know the mayor put them in a position where they really didn't have a choice. But to approve this, I mean, once you get the legislature moving, doing the groundwork for you, and you've got your own, political, you've been doing the groundwork ahead of time. By the time you get to the plan, it's a piece
of cake. And there were critics of this plan saying that it will provide short-term relief, but it's going to cost the city a whole lot more later on.
Well, it's based on a lot of very optimistic assumptions about how the local economy is going to evolve over the next 12, 15 years. And I think that was the major concern is, geez, are we really going to be able to pull off 4.5% growth annually, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, the other thing that it's groundbreaking in this is that the fact that the for the first time, the municipal unions, police, fire, and the city unions have pretty much cut off the future for pension plans, and a real good reason to join a union going forward. Because everybody that's in place now is well taken care of, but all new employees, forget it. And if I'm a new employee, I'm certainly not going to be looking for them to take any union dues out of my salary, because why? Why would I want to do that? I think the unions have, with this agreement, have pretty much made themselves irrelevant.
Well, the trade-off for that down the road is going to be higher salaries, so the city is going to have to be in position to pay people more competitively down the road. Mm-hmm. So, 5-10 years from now, we're going to probably see an increase, or need to see an increase in salaries, or what you see currently around.
But we're not. Yeah. We're not going to see an increase. The increase that they're now, that they're getting, again, the increases for those who are mm-hmm. on board now. That's what they negotiated for themselves. Mm-hmm. But down the line, the city's going to continue to do what they're already doing. Temporary mm-hmm. employees who will be brought on without benefits. You'll be there for at least 6 months to a year. If you behave yourself, you can possibly get on board full time. But we're not going to see that. And that's part of the philosophy. Remember now, that's part of the philosophy of the government we elected. Yeah. They are looking for smaller government, less benefits, and moving people to the private sector.
Well, there is a real sweet thing here for the new employees. I mean, name one IRA plan that would put 25% of your salary away year after year after year. I mean, come on. That's like, that's off the charts.
If generous. If you get hired full time.
Yeah, if you're full time. And these are folks that don't get Social Security.
Yeah.
When they retire, that's the other big piece that people don't realize is that these are not Social Security withdrawers once they reach retirement age. Anyway, I know none of you guys wear Ivanka Trump clothing, but I'm going to ask you to talk about this anyway. The Jackson. Hey, now you never know. No, the Jacksonville-based Steinmart. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
It will not be carrying Ivanka Trump's clothing line, nor another label that has apparently been placed into the Ivanka line. This is kind of a crazy story. And have you heard about the boycott against Ivanka's line? It's the hashtag is grab your wallet for those opposed to the Trump administration. It has resulted in some big retailers like Nordstrom dropping her line. But the Jacksonville-based department store chain Steinmart was in the news this week. They'd been selling Ivanka's stuff. It had been relabeled, though, as Adrian Vittadini Studio. And after this came out, the Steinmart director of investor relations said that they're getting feedback from an equal number of customers who both said they wanted and didn't want Steinmart to carry Ivanka Trump merchandise. So it's really interesting to see this from a business perspective, how a big big department store chain like Steinmart handles this politically sensitive issue.
Yeah, it is. Steinmart, look at their stock. I mean, they've got a lot bigger problems than Ivanka Trump and whether they're going to. Their stock is down 55% since the beginning of the year. That's 4 months. They've lost half their market value. This is not a great thing for them to be involved with, Ivanka Trump, and whether to sell it or not. But boy, they got a lot bigger problems.
I would venture to say this is probably the first time Steinmart had to worry about what brand they carried on the open market. Mm. I'm good with it as long as they keep carrying Levi's.
There you go.
So,
in terms of the rebranding issue, that's what Steinmark's been doing forever. They buy clothes
and
take off the label and put on their own label or some other label.
Or they sell really top brand clothing for a lot less, which is good bargains.
I think probably the worst thing about this whole story is for Steinmart is that in the media and the press that they've been getting, they've been identified as an off-brand store. So they probably had to take a little objection to that because public to know that they can get good stuff there.
Okay, finally, give me your thoughts, gentlemen. As the first round of the NFL draft was last night, did any of you go to the big party? The Jaguars selected LSU running back Leonard Fournette. Jaguars executive VP Tom Coughlin says the team needs playmakers. Fournette scoring 40 touchdowns in 32 games at LSU. What do you think?
It's really difficult to pay attention to anything they're doing until after they win six games.
Fred.
Ditto. We've been there before. We've been there before, and we're watching and waiting until the season starts. And like I said, six games is my benchmark.
Wake me up then.
Yeah.
Okay. Wake me up before you go to six games.
The last running back they drafted in the first round was Fred Taylor.
Right.
If he's half of Fred Taylor, we're going to do great.
All right. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And you know how you say, well, a rhesus monkey could do a better job than that guy? Remember, you know that saying?
Yeah.
Only in Florida do rhesus monkeys hang out on public streets. This happened in Apodaca, where wildlife officials warn residents to stay away from the rhesus monkeys hanging out in the area. And to call a hotline if they see them again. The Orlando Sentinel reports monkeys are natives of Central and South Asia, but they've somehow migrated to Central Florida residential neighborhoods.
Over the border without a passport.
Isn't that the Tarzan thing?
Apparently they were thought to have first been brought here in the 1930s to Silver Spring State Park to bring in tourists. Yeah. And they've only grown from there. Only in Florida do people snort cocaine right in front of police trying to put out brush fires. Whoa. Yes, police in Collier County were working to clear residents from the area as a 5,000-acre brush fire approached when they spotted 25-year-old Joshua Benz enjoying a little blow from his plastic bag right in the middle of a busy street.
So did he start the fire?
You never know. Benz is under arrest. And this one's just for you, Fred. Just so you don't think everyone in Florida is crazy, stupid, or high, only in Florida do good Samaritans spend their days cleaning veterans' tombstones.
Whoa.
Yes, 46-year-old Andrew Loomish of Tampa owns a cleaning service. But he's made it his life's mission to restore forgotten and decaying headstones of military veterans to honor them. Loomish will take bucket scrubs and cleaning products and spend all day wiping up tombstones in veterans' cemeteries around Tampa. He says a really old tombstone can take months to clean, and he takes the time doing it to also learn about the person in order to bring their memory and resting place back to life.
I've got to go down and meet that guy.
Isn't that nice? Yep. Thank you so much. Fred Matthews, Charles Griggs, and John Bird. Gentlemen, have a great weekend, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Mastodon bones and hammer stones found in California could mean humans settled North America 100,000 years earlier than we thought. I'm Ira Flatto on the next Science Friday, how it could rewrite our human history. Plus how math and a 3D printer equals magnificent blooming animations. And if you're a worrywart, good news, don't worry about worrying. But you will anyhow. It's on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
Or the next jazz night in America, piano giant Randy Weston at 90. And I get to hang out with him at his Brooklyn home.
My mother gave me the black church, so I had Panamanian father and a Virginia mama. I'm born in Brooklyn with all the Caribbean and African and all the different people in Brooklyn, you know. So the culturally, it was very rich.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next jazz night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a Jacksonville-based film with a positive message promoting family and adventure. After the death of his wife, a man plans a camping trip with his son. But when mourning her loss turns to honoring her memory, an unexpected journey begins. Here's a listen to a little bit of the new film, Never Go Back.
What's wrong, Mom? Sometimes, Oliver, sometimes I just feel sad for the world.
How come?
They don't know what's already theirs. They waste their lives working for something that already belongs to them. They spend time to make money to live, or pretend to live.
Never Go Back is on the festival circuit, and it is screening in downtown Jacksonville this weekend. We've got our preview with writer-director Durden Godfrey. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also in studio, Jared Rush, owner of Third Man Entertainment. Good to see you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, let's begin with you, Durden. What's Never Go Back all about?
Never Go Back is about a father and son, a father and his adult son. They are the type of people who are at odds with society that they live in. After the unexpected death of the mother and the family, they decide to take a camping trip to honor her memory. And they end up deciding to stay out there to honor her wishes that she had made pretty clear when she was alive. And in hopes to avoid the same fate as her. And that's where the movie begins, is about them building their relationship, learning more about each other, and learning how to survive in the wilderness, because neither of them go into this as wilderness survivors.
And that can be tough.
Yes.
What inspired the story?
I've always wanted to do it personally. When I found out my wife and I were going to have our daughter, the reality kind of set in that it was going to have to be lived out vicariously through a movie production. So that's where the idea came from.
Oh, wow. And when you went into the wilderness areas, how difficult was shooting some of that?
About halfway through the production, I started feeling a little hypocritical about putting the movie out there and telling people to go live in the wilderness, because it was a lot harder to romanticize it once we were out there for 12 hours a day.
Once you're living it. Where did you shoot all locally?
Yeah, majority of the movie was shot in Green Cove at Bayard Conservation Area.
Very nice. Jared Rush, you're the owner of Third Man Entertainment. Never Go Back is making the festival circuit?
Yes, it is.
Tell me about that.
Well, actually, I came on board after the movie was done as associate producer. So when they had a screening at Sunray last year, he had an original cut of, I think, about 2 hours and 10 minutes. And after I saw it, I recognized some things that needed to be cut to make it a better film for the circuit of the film festivals. And that's what he did, and it's been amazing since he did that. How many have you entered now?
Oh, about 25 to 30.
25, wow. 30. And we actually had, the day we went to our first festival in Orlando at the Hollywood East Festival, we also had a premiere in Canada. And then in September, we're actually going to be at TIFF, Toronto International Film Festival, in Nollywood, to premiere our film as well.
Nollywood. You're getting the full taste of what it's like to put your movie out there and try to get distribution.
Yes.
Yeah. That can be challenging, but it's exciting too. And how do you see this film fitting in with the local filmmaking scene in our area, which is really growing?
I'm hoping they embrace it. I mean, it exclusively showcases Florida locations, Florida talent, specifically in Jacksonville. So, and I think it does a good job at representing the city. I'm hoping they, and there's a lot of great places to escape within Jacksonville. So I'm hoping that they embrace it and come away with that you don't, there's other places to go in Jacksonville that don't cost money, and you could take a good camping trip and get lost for a little bit.
Sure. And so Never Go Back is screening Sunday at the Hourglass Pub. That's in the Elbow District in downtown Jacksonville on Bay Street. Jared, you want everyone to come out and support this film and help raise a little money for its efforts.
Yes, please do, because the main thing about Jacksonville, we have some amazing talent of filmmakers, writers, actors. But the problem is a lot of community is so spread out. But if we could just come together as a community, and then the reality of building up what Jacksonville has to offer, then we can take that power to city council, to the mayor, to the governor about tax incentives to get the film industry back in Jacksonville. So it starts in a small level and it could grow.
Right, because the legislature has basically zeroed out those incentives to bring films to Florida. What do you guys think about that?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, as promising as a $10 reimbursement for one hotel stay for productions in Florida is, I think there's a lot of growth to be made, especially from where we came from and where we are now. It's kind of frustrating to see what we allowed to happen to our film community here. And it's weird. It's like a paradox, because the local film community, personally, within like the individuals in it, is growing and getting stronger. But the support system that's set up for it, it just seems to be getting weaker. So, I mean, all that we can do is just keep doing what we do.
Right. I was going to say that is what's interesting is 2 years, Dwayne Johnson's show, Ballers, HBO show, was filmed in Miami.
Yeah.
After season two.
With The Rock.
Yeah, The Rock. Yeah. He left because L.A. said, here's $8 million in incentives for 6 months of filming, 10 episodes. That area brought in $22 million. Who would not want to say, if I give you $8, you can get 22 back?
And how about that Ben Affleck movie filming in Brunswick, Georgia,
Cheaper
Live
to
by
build.
Night, and it was supposed to be set in Ybor City, Tampa, and they didn't even film it in Tampa
it
because they got a better deal in Georgia.
It was cheaper to build an actual Ybor City.
In Brunswick, Georgia.
Yes, than to actually go there.
I know.
It is insane.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things with Third Man Entertainment, my goal is to kind of bring the forces together, the film industry, to like attack that, because there's so many people that are going to Atlanta, which is the new Mecca of Hollywood, and like we're losing great people and great artists and great talent, or we have things here that no one ever sees.
Oh, well, go out and see this film then.
Yes.
If you believe in local filmmaking, it's Never Go Back, shot locally. It's screening Sunday night at Hourglass Pub on Bay Street in downtown Jacksonville. Doors open at?
At 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Could I give a promotional code that I promised?
Sure.
If you go to nevergoback.eventbrite.com, you can get your tickets there and use the promo code FIRSTCOAST and get 25% off your purchase.
Thanks, Durden. Durden Godfrey is the writer-director of Never Go Back. Jared Rush, owner of Third Man Entertainment. Is that after the Orson Welles film, by the way?
Circle gets the square, yes. Correct.
I love that movie.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be right back, everybody.
Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeffrey Toobin talks about the kidnapping and trial of Patty Hearst and where it fit in the culture, politics, and media of the 70s. The newspaper heiress was kidnapped in 1974 by the incoherent, radical, urban guerrilla group, the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army. Toobin's book about Hearst is now out on paperback. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the famed Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Our guests include Lucius, Mr. Brad Meldow, and comic Tom Papa. Plus our acting company, Serena Brooks, Sue Scott, Tim Russell, and sound effects man Fred Newman. My song of the week, our first call radio players, and much, much more.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Welcome back. Well, access to everything from musical theater, visual arts, orchestra performances, and more are among some of the projects the PNC Foundation's Arts Alive program wants to support. With $170,000 in local grants, they want to just give out over the next year. Arts organizations here in Duval County are invited to apply for grants from now through May 15th. This is money you can get to support your vision. Ryan Ali is with the Cultural Council in Jacksonville. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How great is this, isn't it?
Yeah. Tell us about it. PNC Arts Alive.
PNC Arts Alive. So it came out of PNC's foundation. They really believed in a charitable arm. $550,000 commitment to Florida. So Duval, Broward, and Palm Beach counties can apply over 3 years. Last year, we awarded over $75,000 in grants for year one. This year, Duval County has a stake at $170,000 of grants. So we're hoping everyone applies for this. Shows how incredible the art scene is and the community is in Jacksonville. We all know how incredible the community is. And let's get some folks to apply for this one.
Who would qualify, Ryan, for this kind of grant, and how much can they win?
Right. So the cap, I would say, is anything. The sky's the limit. So if you want to reach for $100,000, you could reach for that. Anyone with an operating nonprofit organization status. So you as an artist, if you want to partner with a nonprofit, if you want to partner with a corporation, as an organization or a nonprofit, you can apply for this.
So as long as it's an artistic project,
absolutely,
it is eligible.
It is. So, you know, we're really trying to get folks to take their art and their craft into the community where people may not have experience, you know, theater, art, spoken word, performances. You know, we announced five last year, Jacksonville Dance Theater, which is phenomenal. They're blowing it out of the water. Stage Aurora, we're great friends with Daryl. Players by the Sea is doing Shake Up Shakespeare. Jacksonville Kids Mural Project, which Nicole Holderbaum is doing, I think now 60 schools. So murals in 60 schools. And then, of course, Jacksonville Cultural Development Center, who's doing an Eastside Arts Project.
The movie, the filmmaker we just had in here, his film, he could have applied for something
absolutely,
like this.
He absolutely could. I actually just gave him my card as we intersected.
Yeah. So the deadline, though, is coming up soon.
It's a really quick application. The application is not this daunting application. It is 4 or 5 pages. Get some letter recommendations. Call us. We'll do it for you as well. We'll help you out. We want folks to apply. I think Duval County had the most applicants last year, which is a true testament to the art scene.
This is only eligible to Duval, Palm Beach, and Broward counties?
That's correct. Yeah.
So Jacksonville's sort of lucky to
even be in this. It's a big opportunity for us. We are competing with the likes of, you know, South Florida. And folks have always said that we are top-notch.
South Florida.
Right? We're top-notch art. You know, Wynwood, all that good stuff. But listen, we are doing some amazing things in this town. And we are competing with top-notch artists and organizations out there.
Again, if you're just tuning in, the PNC Foundation's Arts Alive program wants to give you money. Mm-hmm. If you have a really exciting artistic project that you are struggling to get funded, apply. Go to pncartsalive.com. The deadline is May 15th. Ryan Ali with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, spreading the word, and hope a lot of people apply. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, finally, this hour, the Intersections Festival is set for Saturday in historic Springfield. Now, this is an offshoot of the annual, I'd never heard of this, but it's called the Wild Goose Festival in North Carolina. Everything from local speakers to artists and musicians will be around Clutho Park talking about the intersection of spirit, justice, art, and music. The majority of the speakers will come from the Christian tradition, but people of all spiritual leanings are encouraged to come out and add their voices. Organizers Cody Burton and Tim Kerr are here with a preview. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming out. And Tim, tell us about this and how it was inspired by the Wild Goose Festival.
I can do that. We agree with Ryan that there's a lot of impressive, passionate, interesting people in this city. And we found that sometimes the logistics of the city prevent those people from intersecting with each other, to drop a name. We have been longtime attenders of the Wild Goose Festival, and they it's in Hot Springs, North Carolina.
Hot Springs, North Carolina. Okay,
beautiful little mountain town on the French Broad River. It's a 4-day event, and it's same format, if you will. And they tasked a group of us this year to say, "Hey, take this back to your town
And make one happen here.
And make one happen here. And we foolishly maybe took the challenge.
So Cody Burton, what's going to be happening? This is going on almost all day in Clutho Park in Springfield.
Yeah, that's correct. It starts at 11 a.m. and goes all the way until 8 p.m. We have lots of things going on. We have the sacred narrative of coming out stories is one of the things that will open the day. Talking about how coming out stories and those who are LGBT and Christian or of other faith traditions, how that spirituality intersects with that coming out story. We have things about fighting poverty, about violence against women, conversations about race, and so many other things.
And this is all within a spiritual framework, it sounds like. But it also sounds like you're trying to bring people of very different worldviews together.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really one of the key things of the festival and where, you know, the namesake came from is intersecting people of different faith traditions, intersecting people who are doing different great work in our city here, and really bringing everybody together to just intersect, to know each other, and to participate in something great together.
And Tim Kerr, a minute ago, you said that often those interactions don't happen in Jacksonville. Why do you think that is?
Maybe lack of opportunity. You know, we were the one of the things, we had a conference call way back when we started this with some folks from the Wild Goose Festival, and they said, okay, well, at the end of the day, what do you have want? What do you want to have happened? And that was really where our plan came from. At the end of the day, we want a lot of people to say, oh my God, I'm interested in that, and I found somebody else that's doing great work in that. How do I join them instead of trying to recreate the wheel, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
So that's our hope, really, that number one, come out and have a good time. The panel discussions we have set up are a lot of interesting local people. But it's not designed to be a lecture. It's designed for input from the spectators and the crowd. We want to have discussions.
What would you say to people who shy away from events like this because they don't think that there's any common ground to be found? They don't want to give their opinion. You know, I remember when I went through Leadership Jacksonville, there was a group of guys that sat in the back of the class. And every time there would be some tense discussion, they would just sit in the back and they wouldn't say anything. And I ran into one of them after we all graduated, and he said, I didn't really enjoy Leadership Jacksonville. I'm like, why not? He's like, I didn't agree with most of what they were saying. I'm like, well, why didn't you ever speak up and give your opinion? He's like, what's the point? You want to change that.
Yeah, we want to change that. And we want everybody to feel like they're valid. And, you know, a lot of times, especially with festivals or organizations that have that religious type background or come from a faith tradition, you hear all is welcome, but it really doesn't mean all are welcome. And we want to provide a space where it truly means all are welcome in a very inclusive environment.
And people can come out, enjoy, participate, listen to the speakers. I'm sure there'll be a lot of food trucks and yes, maybe some music.
Food trucks, yeah. Music, and beer provided by Spar. They'll be hosting that.
Porch Fest, thank you very much.
And art.
Public
lots of art.
So it's Saturday, the first ever Intersections Festival in historic Springfield. Come on out to Clutho Park. This is inspired by the Wild Goose Festival in North Carolina. Sounds fascinating. Cody Burton and Tim Kerr, thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well.
Thanks
for having us.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download our WJCT app, listen anytime, or catch the podcast on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup, and I'm Melissa Ross. This has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.